Hello, I'm Scott. This is The Joys of Teaching Literature. We're talking about teaching. I'm a high school English teacher, so we're talking about classroom management and thesis statements and poetry, metaphors, synecdoche, metonymy, irony, all the different ironies, dramatic irony, just all that dorky stuff, but mostly how to enjoy teaching, have fun, try to get the stress out of our lives, try to enjoy teaching. laugh, have fun, and just engage in the process of learning about the world, teaching about the world with our students. And so this week we're talking about, titling this, How to Pair Film and Literature. If you want to know more about me, you can go to my website. It's theteachersworkshop.com. I offer online professional development for high school English teachers, and now actually for all teachers. I have three different sort of courses within the one course that I've packaged together now. So there's a ton of different lectures and handouts and different things. It's screen recording, so you can download the handouts and different units that I go over, different student work that I show as examples of what I'm teaching. Sometimes it's technology, sometimes it's just good classroom activities, how to build good relationships with your students, how to keep them engaged and on task. Some of the stuff's sort of for new teachers, some of it's for the veteran teachers, some of it's sort of more college-based courses where I just go through poetry and analyze poetry, so it's really technical. But there's all things for all kinds of whatever you're teaching out there, there's something for you there. So that's theteachersworkshop.com. We started the unit Kite Runner. And so it's interesting because I like to show the film at the end of a unit, never the full film. And that's the first kind of point that I'll make with all this, is that I think it's always more effective just to do clips, show a particular scene. So if you're doing a close reading of a scene and then you show the film version and sort of talk about the differences and, what new things come out of the film version. I don't think there's always it always has to be. I think by the end of this, you're going to probably get this impression that that every time we look at film, it needs to be this hardcore analysis. It doesn't. I think sometimes you just show a clip and have a light conversation that doesn't need to last a really long time. And then it all kind of depends. I think it depends on the novel that you're teaching. It depends on the original text, whatever it might be, if it's a short story or whatever. Sometimes within the poetry unit, I'll show a video of a poem being read. That's just for the point of, hearing the poem in order to comprehend it better. It's not really, I'm not there to kind of, do these extended conversations about, these videos on poems. So, and I think it depends on the film itself. It depends on the text itself. With Hamlet, for example, I always do show the videos, the film versions of Hamlet at the end. And with that one, I think it's sort of with Shakespeare, especially with Hamlet, because his character is so wild, for lack of a better term, or calculated. I mean, that's the question. Is Hamlet wild or is he calculated? And so it's good to see two different versions of that character to say, okay, well, here's how one person saw Hamlet and here's how another director saw Hamlet. What's the difference? And, is Hamlet more noble or more admirable in this one or this other version? And you can look at different scenes. You don't have to look at the same scene, but you can look at the same scene. You can look at different scenes. But I think in that case with Shakespeare, it's important to get to know the language first, because it's so hard to understand what they're trying to say. And then when you see the film, you're like, oh, that's how this language is supposed to sound. Or even doing it before the unit might work well too in this case, right? Because you get to hear the sound of the performance, and it helps sort of with comprehension for that reason. It was meant to be before. It was a play originally, right? Not a text. But if you sort of appreciate the language first, get an idea of who Hamlet is in your head, and then watch the film, you can sort of make an argument about whether or not you think that was an accurate representation of Hamlet, because you have a deep understanding of, a student has a deeper understanding of the character at that point. And so those conversations are more fun if they actually understand who Hamlet is. And they can make a more sophisticated argument there. In the case of the Kite Runner, which I'll talk about, it's so closely aligned to the novel. Now, like a movie does, it kind of just picks lines here and there out of the book, which I guess to some extent you kind of always have to do that because it's such a long text compared to a film. But the images were pretty true, at least the particular scenes that they showed were pretty true to the book. So, and I think they, in my case, you know, got them excited about reading the book because now they have this visual that's in a place that, you know, in their imagination or whatever, nobody's probably been to Afghanistan, right? And so they have this conception of what it looks like. And then in the film, you get to actually see it. And so I think that can do a lot for sparking interest in reading in general. Like, oh, I saw the movie, now I really want to read the book. But also on that analytical level, I mean, you know, in today's world, it's just as important for students to learn how to analyze video as it is to analyze literature. It's actually probably a good argument to be made that it's more important to be able to think critically about an image because students are spending more and more time with images on their phone than they are reading. I'm not sure if that's actual trend. I remember reading this kind of lengthy article about whether or not people are reading more or less, historically speaking, and they said it's just sort of a lot of hype that people are not reading as much as they used to. That's not necessarily true. That's actually maybe the opposite is true, that we're actually reading more than we used to, because books have become more accessible. And so the printing press back when it first started, you know, the prices have been sort of going down as far as, you know, in libraries, think about how much more accessible books are than they used to be. Let's not even talk about education, right? The 19th century, 18th century, people, you know, education was for a select few. So still somewhat true today. You know, I think 33% of the population has a college degree. The population over 25 years old, I think I read 33%. So it's not like, you know, higher education is not as widespread, but we, you know, you have a higher quality, you know, secondary education than we used to in the, say, in the 19th century. So anyway, sort of getting off topic, but obviously it's very, very important to do both, but increasingly important where, you know, our students are spending more and more time online as the years go along. It's really important to be able to look at an image and not, just like when we read literature, we're not going to take it for the complete truth, whether it be fiction or nonfiction. You know, we decide what the truth is, not the text. And so image is the same. I think the tricky thing about the image is that it's presented to you and it's there, and therefore it's real. I think it's hard to convince students to see that an image is a construction of reality. It's just a single slice of a tiny, tiny moment, you know, half quarter of a second in time that represents something much, much larger. An image becomes highly symbolic because of the way that it's, that the frame and the mise-en-scene, if you want to sort of look at, compare it to film, all the different things that are sort of involved in this one action or this event, you know, the objective correlative is kind of, well, another fancy term that T.S. Eliot used to describe the full complete reality of the scene involved, including the dialogue and the action and everything. And so the image is this sort of, you know, it's this loaded thing that represents something beyond itself. And so for that reason, a journalist or artist, painter, any kind of image is this product of a person's imagination. It reflects their experience, but it also reflects a little bit of their imagination. But when you're dealing with a photograph, again, that's kind of like, well, I'm looking at what I'm seeing, so how can it not be the truth? And so to being able to think critically about images is really important. And so movies are really fun because they have music. You know, they move quickly, the shot lasts 5-10 seconds. So here's a shot, and you keep getting these flashing images on top of words, right, which is a literature. So films, and I think over time, you know, there's a couple interesting articles about this, like, is watching TV makes you smarter is the title of one. It sort of makes this argument that TV is actually getting better and better, and that it requires the same skills that we need to acquire to read a novel. We have to keep track of multiple plot lines, multiple characters. We have to think about things like symbolism and the hidden meaning behind words. We have to be able to interpret the different actions of behavior and keep track of the patterns of behavior over long periods of time, especially with series like Netflix series, for instance. I've been watching Offspring for the past couple of months now. It's a great, great series. And you have to keep track of the characters and think about their growth and development and some of their flaws and some of the moments where they sort of ready to fall apart, their internal conflict. The narrative style, where at least in Offspring you have these sort of flashes of imagination that are sort of reflective of her anxiety, the main character's anxiety. And so you have these sort of, not that that's that cutting edge, but there's these sort of experimental stylistic things with how to tell a story. Like, Orange is the New Black, there was a whole season of a riot. I mean, that was insane. It was a whole season of like 3 hours of this one riot not 3 hours. I think the riot lasted a couple of days. I can't remember. But either way, there was a whole season just for like these couple of days. And so time's sort of worked in this truly linear fashion where you're actually watching every second of the riot unfold. And that's pretty cool, because that's not how typical narrative works, right? You're just kind of skipping along in time, and like a rock on a pond, that you fling out there, and it just kind of skips and keeps going so fast, and you're not comprehending all the different spaces that you're skipping over. So they need to think critically about images they encounter. There's so many of them, right? Movies, television shows, social media, of course, the news. They also need to talk about the difference between images and words. And this is always a great movie. I think it's called Images and Words. There's a great little poem in it too, by the way, if you get the chance to listen to it. It's like these two teachers, art teacher and literature teacher, competing with each other. I think it's like some kind of school competition with the best poem or the best painting. What's better, a poem or a painting? It's like this sort of public debate between these writers and painters. I can't remember. There's another plot with the teacher, but so the difference, right, is that images make us guess at internal thoughts and feelings, and words, on the other hand, function as a translation of a person's internal world. Both words and images often fall short of representing the truth or reality. Even though our degrees trained us to interpret words, film has become more and more literary as time passes. So it's sort of interesting. I mean, I definitely think that it's important that we focus on text. If you listen to any of my podcasts, you'll kind of figure out the different reasons that I think text is so magical and wonderful. There's no reason to keep these media or subjects, if you want to call it that, these fields of knowledge separate from each other. Science works that way, where there's different, engineering and architecture. You're combining all the different fields into something that is real, right? And is taps into something that touches people. That's the objective of literature, is to tell a good story, to touch people emotionally. And so that's why we're here. I think we get into these sort of philosophical conversations about, we can't just play movies. This is sort of where I'm going to be getting into. We can't just play movies all day. These kids watch movies all day anyway. And so there is a part of me that wonders, like, what is the space for, like, there is, obviously you can just major in film, right? So we can always just say like, well, there's an elective in high school, and then if you want to go to college and study film, you can do that. But as far as general education is concerned, like, do we want every single child to have this ability, when they graduate from high school, where they might be just going off into work, to have this ability to think about film, television, all these things I'm saying, social media? I taught social, it's called media studies. It was an elective. So some kids took that course and some kids didn't. But don't we think that that's somewhat of, should be somewhat of a requirement? And if it kind of like everything falls on us as English teachers, we're teaching words. So anything that is a word, you know, is I guess what we're supposed to be teaching, you know, and we just have to determine what is literature and what's not. So yeah, while our focus is so much on text, there is just so many questions. So I think that's the kind of happy medium. Now, I've taught full films before. I've taught film appreciation for that's another course, an elective course I taught. I think that there is some place in our curriculum. You know, it's always a challenge. You want to get graphic novels in there. You want to get not regular novels in there. Short stories, poems. You want to listen to poetry as well as read it. You know, there's so much literature out there now. You know, you can't do everything. There's only a limited amount of time. So some of it has to be reserved for college, obviously. But it doesn't mean we can't dabble. And so that's basically what I try to do is dabble. I've taught full films before. There's a place for them in the curriculum somewhere, I think. But of course, with any unit that you teach, usually there's some movie. Again, I don't think it's good to just fall into a habit of always showing film clips with every single novel. Sometimes the novel is just good on its own. You don't need to do a movie clip with it. But that's, I think, the interesting conversation that comes out of, and of course, I think the overall lesson learned here is that when you read, you need to visualize. And sometimes I'll start the year with some kind of activity where they have to visualize that first text that I used to do it with Beowulf. It's like, all right, visualize this monster. Like, think about how important it is to visualize this monster, because we get caught in this trap of just looking for plot and motif and symbolism and all these different things that we forget to actually just read very slowly so that we can understand the emotions and the tone, but also the actual to actually experience it requires a wild imagination. There's obviously a value in comparing movies to books, because that's in a way what we're saying is, what's the movie that's unfolding in your head as you're reading this book? That's really important, because I think the image is what kind of triggers, there's something emotional happens when we can see somebody's eyes and their body language. Obviously words evoke a lot of emotion too. But when we see someone, it's just like why people treat different people differently on the internet. Why can somebody say something nasty on the internet and just go away into cyberspace or whatever and not deal with the repercussions? Like, because there's no consequence. There's no, when you say something to somebody's face, you can see the emotional reaction. So you're not a jerk when you're walking on the street and opening doors for people to go into a convenience store and these little. We shopping for clothes. Strangers are super nice to each other, but they're horrible to each other on the internet, and that's why, because we can't see each other. So there's definitely an intersection where these worlds. There's something where these worlds intersect. That's an interesting place to explore. So what I'm going to do is kind of take you through three different sort of ways of interpreting film, and then three sort of literary ways of interpreting film. So that's the first piece of advice I already gave, is to compare passages to clips. So, I mentioned this already, but I don't usually show a full film unless it's truly a masterpiece, and you can treat it like you would treat a novel, where you can really go through it, and it provokes thought, provokes conversation. A lot of film, it just doesn't let your students sink their teeth in like a good novel, where you can really have a good conversation about a couple of pages of text. There's a few films that I taught film appreciation, and we did have some good conversations, but it is a little bit more challenging to extract meaning out of a film, because you watch it. It's an interesting thing about teaching literature is that you say, hey, go read the book at home, and then you reread the book in class. And so I would try to do that with film, where you watch the film, and then you do the kind of close reading where you rewatch it and you stop the frames, which I'll get to that in a second. The study of film does deserve its own. It can be a college course, but it's fairly easy to learn how to analyze a short clip from a movie. So rather than doing, I prepared and read a lot to teach film appreciation, So I felt like I could be considered an expert in that field, you know, even though you have, you know, if you ever taught an elective, you got freshmen in there and then you got seniors who want to do this in college in there, and you have to kind of cater to both. But yeah, so I think that's the really effective thing is to do a close reading and do a you know, read a passage from the novel out loud, and then you look at the scene from the novel, and we do that with Kite Runner. It's important that they visualize the scene first, I think, in general. I mentioned this already, too. And then you get to experience the director's vision and see if it matches up with your vision. So I don't think it's that effective to do it the opposite way, where you show the film first and then the text. Because, and then this is the other sort of challenge, I think, with film and text, is that the film sometimes doesn't like it, like adds stuff, right? It's an adaptation. So it's, you, there's a lot of creative license, if you will, when you make a film where you don't have to, it doesn't have to be a perfect representation of the novel, of course, right? There is no such thing as a, right, as a text that does the same thing as the movie. So yeah, for that reason, it might be confusing if there's different plot points or it's presented in such a way that it's going to confuse, like you want your kids to understand the novel. That's the objective, not the movie. Again, unless you're just going to teach the movie on its own as its own separate piece of art, and then you can kind of, but yeah, it gets kind of confusing when you're going back and forth between these two things that are not exactly perfectly alike as far as the plot, the flashbacks, and all that stuff that films do, the voiceovers, right? Sometimes you get voiceovers that don't have a place, or there's new characters or something. So you don't want to confuse, you know, reading a novel is hard enough. We don't want to confuse them by, oh, wait, was that the movie or was that the book? You know, that sort of thing. So you have to be careful about that. But yeah, I already kind of mentioned what I do. So the second piece of sort of advice I'm giving with this is to compare different versions or an adaptation. So I mentioned Hamlet, we do the David Tennant version, and then we do the Mel Gibson version. And we talk about how they're sort of presenting themselves as what everybody else considers as mad or not mad or calculated. And you know, really, when you think about when he stages the play in the play, that's really calculated and smart. It's a very logical thing to do. He's using art to expose corruption at the highest position power in society, right? That's brilliant. Like he's having a play in front of the king. So, you know, that's, think about, yeah, media today, you're always potentially have a president as your audience. But when James and Elizabeth were actually in their audiences, that's pretty cool. It's very meta in that way. Shakespeare actually wrote plays that the king saw himself. And so Shakespeare is in a position of power, because if he can write a play that inspires the audience to want democracy more by criticizing people in power, that is an incredible position to be in. The more that we can question what's going on at the very top of the power structure in a society, that's really good, right? So that's sort of interesting. Anyway, so that's, we're sort of comparing those two. And of course, talking about how it helps us understand the text, the original text. When I taught the novel Emma, we compared it to the film adaptation of Clueless. Now, we did the Gwyneth Paltrow performance as well. But to understand the relevance of this text, it's kind of stuffy and people are very, very polite to the point where they're not saying anything. That's sort of the problem of the book, is that people are so polite that they're not saying anything. They're just like sort of half saying things and indicating that they might feel a certain way, but they're not completely open and honest. And that's the danger of being too obsessed with etiquette and social codes and social class. And so Clueless is this world of Beverly Hills High School. I actually watched that movie when I was, I think I might have been in middle school, I can't remember. But it was very much like that world is what, yeah, it's amazing showing it today, because they're like, oh, there's the TV crew. They think they're so important. And, you know, there's those guys that just kick a sack around on the lawn all day. And, you know, so all those kind of stereotypes of cliques that exist in high school, are that's very much the social world of Emma in 1814, where it's like, well, the farmer's going to hang out over here, and you know, us old money people, we're going to hang out over here. Oh, this new guy, the Coles, he's in, he just started his, you know, major industry, you know, whatever. And he's not that cool, but I guess we'll hang out with him and that sort of thing. So they're like, oh yeah. So that Austin is very much just, you know, in the language of 1814, but living a reality that's very similar to the one that we have today. And so movies have that potential too. The third thing is to freeze frames for longer conversations. So interpreting a few shots from a scene is just like close reading phrases or lines from a poem. So what you do is you push pause, especially on important shots. This involves obviously a little bit of lesson planning and preparation. But honestly, it's fun. Sometimes if you just kind of, you're watching it, you're talking about it, what I'll do is actually I'll mute, you know, show the clip, of course. But then when I'll play it again, and I'll push mute. So you're not listening to the characters. I did this a lot in film appreciation. So you're not listening, you're not distracted by what people are saying to each other. You're just focused on the image. And then as I teach, and especially when I did this in film appreciation, I would just push, when I saw a shot that I knew I could talk about, I would push pause. Then I just ask a question, you know, what do you think about this frame, this shot? What's symbolic about it? What's the location of the characters? Who's high? Who's low? You know, all these different kind of basic things. Where's the sun? Where's the light, right? Where's the shadow? Why is the shadow there? What about this object over here? So you can really talk about this single image for a long time. And you can see how the parts, and so if you keep pushing pause at different parts of the scene or in the movie, then they can do what they do with literature. It's sort of the definition of analysis, right? Is where you see how the parts comprise the whole and how the whole movement of a particular scene. I remember, what was the name of the, I can't remember the book that I read about film interpretation, but it came with a DVD, or I think it was called Seeing Film. I can't remember, but they looked at, it's going to slip my mind, Juno, and the scene where Juno's in the Planned Parenthood or the abortion clinic, whatever it is, and she's like sort of weighing on her, and there's a, you know, protester from her class outside the doctor's office, and so they really take you through every single frame, and it's amazing because that whole thing unfolds in a couple of minutes, and you just kind of, it's just like another scene in a movie, but when you see all the different sort of things going on in the film, it's truly amazing. So that's kind of what I'll do, is just freeze frame either, you know, in one movie or even just one scene in one movie, and just pausing it just kind of opens up the conversation, you know, either just playing again with no sound or pushing pause at different parts, allows people to really see things that they didn't see when they first watched the clip. And that's when they'll start raising their hand. Like, when, you know, it's an amazing feeling, right? When all the hands in the class are in the air, you're like, oh my gosh, everybody wants to say something, right? Because it's right there in front of them. And so that's really fun. It gives students a chance to think about what they're seeing instead of quickly being quickly whisked along to the next visual or sound. All right, so the other thing that you're maybe thinking about with all of this, that I've been thinking about as I've been teaching this Kite Runner film, is... you know, how can we look at film in a literary fashion, like where we can say, all right, here's these literary techniques, here are the cinematic techniques, right? So point of view is a clear sort of point of comparison, right? And I'll go back to the Emma example. In a lot of ways, in Emma, Austin played director with limited omniscient narration. It's exactly what she was doing before film was even a thing. She was basically thinking about, where am I placing this camera? Whose emotions are you looking at right now? When you zoom in on a character, because they're crying because somebody just cursed at them, and you want to see how they're going to react. You know, because they just won the lottery, and you want to see how they react. Right? You get this is a zoom, and the close up, it's called, right? And that's what Austin is doing. She's giving us a close-up with limited omniscient narration. You're only getting the point of view of a couple of different characters and not all of them. So you're really only understanding a few, and the ones that you don't know about, that's the tricky part, because you think you know what they're thinking, but you don't. presents. In the novel, she only presents Emma's point of view for the most part. She gives a couple others. So we're not sure what the characters truly feel. We can only imagine what they feel. So in the movie, the director does the same thing. They focus kind of on Emma, which prevents the audience or us from understanding the other characters that are not being shown on the camera. So that's the comparison piece. The audience then, misunderstands reality. Just that's the sort of comedy of the whole thing, is that there's this sort of cosmic irony in the end. You're like, wait, who loves who and why? Like, and there's a letter involved, and so movies do that. With the Gwyneth Paltrow version, she has this journal that she's writing in that sort of happens in the novel. And so ultimately, point of view in film is all about the location of the camera. So that's how you can kind of talk about that in your classes. Place and symbolism is the other sort of angle. Of course, you're looking at it, right? It's there it is. There's the scene. There's the room, the window with the light coming through, or the horse riding by, or whatever it might be. It's true. A picture is 1,000 words. It takes a few pages of text to present a single shot from a movie. Right? A good example of, in Kite Runner at least, is this crane or drone shot. The camera flies around with these kites. These kids are flying, like there's hundreds of kites in the air. And so I remember reading it thinking, like, what are they do? Because I never partook in a kite flight. So I was like, what's a kite fight, right? And so this camera is kind of in the air and showing you what the kids are doing as they're trying to like sort of wrap their kite around another one and give it a yank to get the other kite to fall. And you're like, oh, so this is what they're talking about in the book. I'm flying around seeing these kites in flight. And at the same time, in the background, you're seeing the mountains of Kabul, and you're getting this sort of bird's eye view of the city. So you actually get to see Afghanistan. You're like, whoa, I'm like actually looking at this place that, you know, it was this mysterious thing, you know, that I didn't know about, you know, and that here it is. You can see the snow on the streets, and there's all these kids on the rooftops of the houses. And you can see all of that at the same time, the mountain, the snow, like all of it. It's pretty incredible. Looking at a house or an object on a screen helps students realize its symbolism or its greater meaning. And it, again, you can freeze the frame and kind of talk about that symbolism as you're looking at it, right, with your own eyes as opposed to just the words on the text. The second thing is body language and tone. So this is a big part of literature too. It's gesture, really, if you want to use a literary term. Tone is right the emotion behind the words. And so that's what sort of gesture is about, is like guessing what the emotion behind the person is. When you have a first-person narration, because you only have access to one person's consciousness, this is particularly important. In reality, most communication happens non-verbally. So we rely on the little things to know what someone feels. You know, they look down at their shoes, they step backwards, they raise an eyebrow, they put their hands on their hips, right? So you can, in a book, you're looking at the words. In the movie, you're looking at the person, and you're thinking about and having a conversation about what it is they're feeling. Tone, or the emotion behind the words, is easier to detect in a movie than it is in literature. In movies, we can hear a character shout or whisper or speak slowly to indicate that they're mad, for instance, or that they have a secret or figuring something out. But none of that's obvious. There's a way of figuring it out with words on a page, but it's not, if you hear somebody shout, the emotion is obvious. So that's a sort of a good conversation starter, right? Is, all right, well, this is what we just read. Now look at how they presented it, where he's shouting. Is that how you saw it? That sort of thing. And the last thing is kind of not necessarily a literary technique, but it is. It's more of a technique in poetry, but as we all know, you know, prose can be highly poetic too. So the final thing is music. And so in the movie The Kite Runner, you're hearing this band play Afghan music at the protagonist at Amir's birthday party. And it really enhances the scene. It's like when I first saw it on the movie, I was like, oh yeah, this is a really, like I get the energy of the space and I get why Amir really admired his father, because like I could hear this band and it's like you have a band playing at your birthday, like that's cool. And they have this out the area outside his house that's got a wall that surrounds it. And all those details are in the book, but seeing it in the movie really, really brought it alive. Get to see the lights at night, string lights lighting the place up, that sort of thing. And so it just becomes really magical to actually see it. And what's interesting about it too is that once the Taliban takes over and Amir comes back to Afghanistan, it's a very, very quiet place. Right? There's no music playing anywhere. And so that silence is juxtaposed to the loudness of the music early on in the movie. And so that's early on in the novel too. But they actually hear that difference. It's much more dramatic. If you've taught The Great Gatsby, it's obviously something that's really important there, right? Is how does the music? I have this activity on my teachers page where we basically just look at descriptions of music in the text and look at those sort of party scenes where they're playing jazz, and look at the musical or lyrical quality of the prose itself. And how is it like jazz, basically, is the kind of question that I ask in that activity. So that's all we look at through the whole novel of The Great Gatsby are these scripts of jazz. And actually, when I have the kids complete that activity, I'll play early jazz music to sort of get them to really understand the comparisons and music from that time period. Charlie Parker, I think, is who I usually play, to get them to really sort of gain an ear for the musical quality of the words and the sounds and how the sounds correspond and that sort of thing. We talk about like the prepositional phrases and the lists and all the punctuation and how it's like moving you around. And so that's kind of interesting. So when you watch the movie, you can really get into that because the music is playing and it makes you realize how connected the language is to the music. So I'll sometimes sort of do that with close readings. That comparison between the prose and the music is easier when you can actually hear it for yourself. They probably haven't heard it, right? Especially from that time period, big band music and all that different stuff going on at the time. So that's the last sort of, I guess you call it literary technique used in film. When we give students the chance to explain what they see on a screen, we help them do the same in their own lives. The people they watch at the mall, they glance around the dinner table in the evening, they watch their coach explain a winning strategy, all the while trying to figure out what's going on beneath the surface. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy listening, please give me a rating wherever you listen to your podcast. I'd really appreciate it.